around here in Britain, in your pocket.
How horrible. Fantastic. Incredible it is.
I do not regard existing conditions lightly.
Quote, unquote. We present another edition of the game based on well-known sayings and some which haven't been said yet. It's devised and introduced by Nigel Rees.
Hello again. According to Robert Benchley, the American humorist,
the surest way to make a monkey of a man is to quote him.
And making a monkey out of Robert Benchley and others this week, we have Ronald Fletcher, whose voice you've just heard, and a panel consisting of playwright and lampoonist John Wells, the best-looking spin-off from I'm Sorry, I'll Read That Again, Joe Kendall, the man who's always making King's Cross, Richard Boston, and the recently retired toast of Broadway, Peter Cook. And as all but Richard are new to the game, we'll break you in with some nice, easy quotations. First of all, John Wells, can you tell me who said or wrote this?
If I can write before I die one line of purest poetry, or crystallize for all to share a thought unique, a moment rare, within one sentence clear and plain, then I shall not have lived in vain.
Mary Gladys Wilson.
Absolutely right. Would it be true to say that you have written more parodies of Mrs. Wilson's poetry than she has written poetry?
And she's had hot dinners. Yes, but she writes quite a few herself.
Well, that was a quote from Mrs. Barry Wilson's selected poems, which were published long ago in 1970. Joe Kendall.
My idea of heaven is eating pâté de foie gras to the sound of trumpets.
Well, I intend to be wonderfully consistent in this programme. I don't know.
And I'll pitch the others, then. Richard Boston.
Sidney Smith.
It was the Reverend Sidney Smith, so you get 2 marks extra for that. Can you give me a one-word summary of this recorded quotation?
Cette question-là, c'est toute la question. On ne peut pas dire qu'elle soit actuellement résolue. Est-ce qu'elle le sera un jour? Seul, évidemment, l'Angleterre peut répondre.
Well, I've got to give a one-word answer.
A one-word summary of that quotation.
Non.
Why did you say that?
Well, it must have been en général. De Gaulle in 1723, when we made one of our many applications to join the common market.
In 1963, actually. What he said was, can our English friends transform themselves? This is the real question. It cannot be said that at the present time Britain is ready to do these things. Will she ever be? To that question, only Britain can reply.
He didn't say that at all.
No, what he was saying was totally different from that, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, was how you cook an omelette, you know. Those who understand French in the audience will be able to understand that.
No, I think the person who understands French will understand that it was an invitation to Mr. Callahan, as he then was, to go to Morocco for an operation.
Well, just in case you should be disappointed, here's an actual recording of General de Gaulle saying non.
Non.
And so to Peter Cook, who said this?
I want to be alone.
Well, it's too easy, you're putting me in. I think it was Miss Greta Garbo.
2 marks. In fact, this is one of those quotations which nobody can really sort of find out where it was first said, according to Alexander Walker in his book Sex in the Movies, that it's impossible to find the remark in any of the publicity or...
No, it was first said in a toilet in Detroit. And I think she had a fair point.
Not too.
Garbo did say subsequently, I never said I want to be alone.
That's her other big one. Yeah. Imagine making a living, make a whole career out of saying, I want to be alone, then that lasts for about 10 years, and another big quote comes up. I never said I want to be alone.
And so back to John Wells.
Satire is a sort of glass wherein beholders do generally discover everybody's face but their own.
Well, I think that was the Dr. Jonathan, not Dr. Jonathan Miller, but Dr. Jonathan Swift.
Absolutely right. And not unconnected with that, Joe Kendall, who said this?
The purpose of satire, has been rightly said, is to strip off the veneer of comforting illusion and cozy half-truth. And our job, as I see it, is to put it back again.
Joe.
It was very funny. I don't know, with wonderful consistency.
I think we'll have to start awarding you marks for consistency. So I think four marks to Joe for consistency, and I'll offer it to the others. Peter Cook.
Just going on the law of probability, somebody called Smith.
No, I'm afraid it wasn't. It was Michael Flanders in At the Drop of Another Hat a long time ago. Richard Boston, here's a quotation from Shaw's Back to Methuselah. Can you tell me who was or who were always quoting it?
Some men see things as they are and say, why? But I dream things that never were and say, why not?
I haven't a clue. No idea.
Offer it to the others.
Smith.
It wasn't Smith. It was, in fact, always being said by the Kennedys, Jack and Bobby. They went around saying this.
Did they really?
Yes. Finally, in this round, Peter Cook.
This is the operative statement. The others are inoperative.
It's Ron Ziegler.
Yes. Absolutely right, yes. Who was?
The press secretary to the ex-president of the United States.
Milhouse.
Mr. Richard Milhouse Nixon.
Yes.
Whom God preserve. Because nobody else gives a...
Yeah, this was Ron Ziegler's way of saying that the previous statement was a lie. This is the truth. We move on to some famous last words, or at least I hope they're fairly famous. And these really are supposed to be what people said before they breathed their last. John Wells.
The sun is God.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear, I do know that one. And I... Oh, I know. That Turner.
J.M.W. Turner, yes. Joe Kendall.
Get my swan costume ready.
I'd like to think it was Rudolf Nureyev.
Well, that's very, very near.
But it could possibly be...
That neck of the woods. I'm trying to help you.
Yes, that neck of the swan. It was probably Pavlova?
Yes, it was. Anna Pavlova, the ballerina, who was still touring at a fairly ripe old age. And this is what she said. Get my...
It was Lord Goodman.
It's not law against it.
Richard Boston.
So little done, so much to do.
Oh, I'm sure all of us have said it.
Offer it to the others. We don't know either.
Attlee.
Apart from Peter Cook, who's going to say Smith again.
Attlee.
Attlee. No, it wasn't Attlee. It was Cecil Rhodes. Who'd really done quite enough.
That's very thin.
Now, listen to this. Peter Cook.
I am Heinrich Himmler.
Whose last words were there?
Freud. I'll go along with the majority here and put
Smith.
It down to Himmler.
It was.
Why did he say it? I mean, was he...
Well, he
was very unsure of himself. Throughout most of his life, he went on saying, I am Heinrich Himmler.
And
occasionally saying, am I Heinrich Himmler? Heinrich Himmler bin ich? Weiß nicht. Whatever the hell I am, I'll stick with it. It's been a winning formula.
In fact, he was surrendering to the Allies, and when he surrendered, he had a phial of poison in his mouth, and he said these words, and then he committed suicide. In the next round, panel, I'm going to ask you not to recognise famous last words, but to provide some famous last words for people whose last words were either not recorded or not as apposite as one might have liked. So, first of all, can I have some... last words, some suitable last words for the escapologist Harry Houdini.
Well, he would have found some way out of it. there must be some way of unpicking even a rigor mortis lock.
I'd like to give a little appendix to that story because, in fact, Houdini prided himself in his great physical fitness, and he was always saying to people, punch me, test me. And what happened, in fact, is very sad that somebody did.
This is the true story, you're not making this up, are you?
And it hit him in the appendix, which is why I'm telling you this story, and he ruptured his appendix and died, saying, oh, what careless rupture.
But apart from the final words, in fact, that is what happened to him, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, some students surprised him. All right, let's move on to another American. What might Edison, the inventor of the the electric light bulb, the phonograph, etc. What might he have said for his last words?
I thought he might have said, now, wait a minute. If I connect the yellow and green wire to this terminal... Or alternatively, if he invented the gramophone, I thought he might have finished up saying...
Well, thank you very much, panel, for your very good offers. Now back to real quotations. Ronald Fletcher is going to read you a list of sayings all by the same person. As soon as you think you know who that person is, then leap in with your buzzers, and the first person with the correct answer gets 2 marks. Ronald.
Running a country is like playing the organ. You have to use all the stops. Pull out one.
John Wells.
Edward Heath.
No, it's not Edward Heath. So, John Wells, would you kindly retire to the blue corner whilst Ron continues?
Pull out one, push back the other. It is not like playing the penny whistle. If people want a sense of purpose, they should get it from their archbishop. They should certainly not get it from their politicians. It's no use crying over spilt summits. Power? It's like a Dead Sea fruit. When you achieve it, there's nothing there. You've never had it so good.
Richard just got in first. Who might that be?
Yes, Harold Macmillan.
Yes, they were all things said by Harold Macmillan. And here's another of the same sort of thing, exactly the same format, all quotations by the same person. I'd like to know who.
Daniel Webster struck me like a steam engine in trousers.
John Wells.
Edward Heath. And yet...
If you say Edward Heath again, I shall start scratching us. You must retire again and carry on, Ronald.
Macaulay has occasional flashes of silence.
Richard Boston.
Sidney Smith.
Oh, gosh, yes, he's right.
Why does the
I answered
engine...
correctly before.
He did, yes.
Before when?
Smith. I anticipated that question.
He did say Smith.
I said Smith several questions back.
It's the wrong question.
Uri Geller. All right. Your heart out.
Would you like to store up any more answers before we get on to the questions?
No, Jones I'm going with next.
All right, Jones. We'll see if we can get you a Jones in. Ronnie, you had a long list of Smithisms.
Yep, yep. Macaulay has occasional flashes of silence that make his conversation perfectly delightful. How can a bishop marry? How can he flirt? The most he can say is, I will see you in the vestry after service. I never read a book before reviewing it. It prejudices a man, sir.
Right, sir.
But you've left out the best one of all, when Sidney was walking along a street and there were two women screaming at one another from opposite sides of the street, leaning out of their windows, hurling abuse at one another, and he said, those two will never agree. They are arguing from different premises.
Oh. Right, we'll take off another 2 marks. And with the score at the moment with, I'm afraid, Richard Boston well out in front, and John and Peter holding hands second, and Joe with remarkable abilities remaining absolutely last, we move on to some musical quotations, or that is to say, quotations which are all embedded in songs. So I'd like you to prize them out and tell me where they come from. John Wells.
Up bells go ting-a-ling-a-ling for you, but not for me. And the little devils only sing-a-ling-a-ling for you, but not for me. Oh, death, where is thy sting-a-ling-a-ling? Oh, great thy victory. The bells of hell go ting-a-ling-a-ling for you, but not for me.
Oh, how nice to have some music.
Lovely number.
That lovely number...
Loved it.
...incorporates a quotation from somewhere, and I'd like you to tell me...
Well, of course, it's the Littlewood production of Oh, What a Lovely War,
yeah.
And also used at the end of Brendan Behan's Hostage.
Yes.
And it is, of course, the quotation is, the bells of hell go thing and whatnot, and it was actually said by... this man called Jones, as... oh, death, where is thy sting? Where is thy grave? Where is thy victory?
Yes.
That was said by some religious person, probably God.
near author, but in fact, I'll give you the marks because you've got the general area right here. Oh, death, where is thy sting? Oh, grave, where is thy victory? Comes from the first epistle of Paul to the Corinthians.
Well, as we know that the Bible is divinely inspired directly by God, I get full marks.
Absolutely. As you also recognise, it's incorporated in a popular song of the First World War, which was incorporated in a show called Oh, What a Lovely War. Joe Kendall.
sigh no more, sigh no more. Grey clouds of sorrow fill the sky no more. Joy is yours to the door. Sweet and beguiling lady, sigh no more, sigh no more. Sweet and beguiling ladies, sigh no more.
It was sung by Noel Coward.
Yes.
But it was writ by Mr. Shakespeare in a play.
It's from, anybody know?
Yeah. Oh, it's Much Ado, isn't it?
It is, indeed, Much Ado About Nothing. No. Yeah, sigh no more, ladies. He got it right. Perhaps we ought to give him a mark. How's he doing?
No, we won't have a mark. This game.
Sigh no more, ladies. Sigh no more. Men were deceivers ever. Used by Noel Coward as the title of a song and of a show. Richard Boston.
Make out a single word.
Ah, well, I'll offer it to the others, then.
I could find a quotation.
I'll offer it to the others.
It was the,
John Wells.
Lord Goodman Swing Chorale. Lyric by Charlie Drake.
No, I'll have to pass it down the pound to anybody else. Your Shakespeare's have been very good so far, Peter, do you know?
Yes, I think it's probably, Shakespeare.
Or Jones.
Shakespeare or Jones?
Yeah, or Jones. Or
oh, Smith and double Jones, they don't Jones. Make double acts like Shakespeare and Jones. He could balance an egg on his nose for 15 minutes. And people in the stack of the balls could hear his voice. Oh, Shakespeare and Jones, they don't make them like that anymore with these microphones. The old days at the BBC when he always used to gather together in the heart of London and shout at the nation. Those are the great days of radio.
Absolutely right, of course. It was in The Merchant of Venice. Soft stillness and the night become the touches of sweet harmony. Act 5, Scene 1.
Well, naturally, if you'd said that,
set to music there by Vaughan Williams, his serenade to music first played at Sir Henry Wood's Golden Jubilee concert at the Albert Hall in 1938. Surprised you weren't there. Peter Cook, you'll have to wait for this one, and it's slightly scrambled.
So we flunch them out of attics, we beg them from our friends, we buy them up in auction lots with other odds and ends. Then we drag them across the meadows where the moon is in the sky. So watch the wall, my darling, while the bedstead mend.
Oh, gold.
Oh, gold. Yes,
oh, everybody knows the poem,
well.
Don't they? It's one of those things which made me, I think, ill when I was young.
Yes.
It's a poem about watching the wall, my something, my darling, while the gentlemen go by. And it was written, obviously, by a poet, I'd say.
Getting warm.
Narrowing it down. And
Peter, if you can, Peter, if you can quote to me the verse, I'll give you a mark.
It is, they come in steaming ships of yore, they move across the sand, and everyone can tell at once that they have not one band, but they have two, and they come in, they walk upon the sea. And hello to you and Gunga Din. You wrote this, not me.
Unfortunately, that doesn't include the line, so watch the wall, my darling.
Well, that's the chorus.
It comes, in fact, from A Smuggler's Song by Rudyard Kipling. Brandy for the parson, baccy for the clerk, places for a lady, letters for a spy, watch the wall, my darlings, while the gentlemen go by. Used there by Flanders and Swann in The Bedstead Men. Now, there are some familiar phrases, particularly political ones, which it's difficult to say how they arose. But can you tell me with whom the following phrases are associated, and if you happen to know, where they originated? John Wells.
Lame ducks.
It was said by Egbert Spotwhistle after he'd trodden on a duck in 1834. How did anyone expect you to know that?
I would have thought if you'd been around in November 1970, Richard Boston?
I think it was the Minister of Industrial something or other, who was called John Davis.
Yeah.
Spotwhistle was the first one to spot
the lame ducks by Spotwhistle.
Spotwhistle did lean heavily on Davis, actually.
He leaned heavily on the duck, definitely. Why.
Was said by John Davis, who was in fact echoing something Tony Benn had said in February 1968. The next question is, what safeguards are there against the support of lame ducks? Moving on, Joe Kendall, here's the first recorded use of another well-known phrase. Can you tell me who's using it?
This is a pause rather than a wage freeze, and I think the union leaders will have regard to the interests of their own members, and there's no doubt at all the interests of their own members are very much bound up in this kind of pause, because it's that which will secure the continuance of full employment, the competitiveness of British industry, and means their wages will continue to purchase what they purchase today. Otherwise, if we don't have this sort of pause, we're going to have continued inflation, we're going to price ourselves out of our export markets, and that isn't going to help any trade union member.
So, Joe, who is thumping the table about wage freeze?
The answer is just on the tip of Richard Boston's tongue.
No, it could have been absolutely anybody. It was absolutely everybody, wasn't it? Every politician.
I'll tell you that it was in July 1961. It was the Chancellor of the Exchequer. All right, Peter.
It couldn't have been Selwyn Lloyd, was it?
Yes, the youthful Selwyn Lloyd, Chancellor of the Exchequer in 1961. Richard Boston, for you, slightly away from politics.
The establishment.
Now, where did that phrase come from?
Well, this could go on for some time. Peter Cook on my left was a proprietor, I think, or something closely involved with an organisation of that name. Before that, there was a book by... I think the idea of the establishment... Wasn't it Paul Johnson and Hugh Thomas dreamt it up? No. Nowadays, of course, people call it the system, I think.
You've thrown various hats into the ring, none of which is absolutely right. I'll offer it to the others. Peter Cook?
I think it was Anthony Sampson.
No, it wasn't. I'll have to tell you, it was Henry Fairley, in a series of articles in The Spectator in the late 50s, first used the phrase. Yes. Hugh Thomas, whom you mentioned, Richard, edited a book called The Establishment, which he defined as the English Constitution and the group of institutions and outlying agencies built around it to assist in its protection. Peter Cook?
Yes. Angry young man.
Let me rephrase the question. With whom was it associated? And
well, it was associated with John Osborne. I'm trying to think who first described Osborne's work. I imagine it'd be the only reviewer who actually liked the play at the time. It should be Harold Hobson.
No. I'll give you a mark, actually, for John Osborne. In fact, the phrase Angry Young Man seems to have come from the title of a book by a gentleman called Leslie Paul, and the title of the book was Angry Young Man. And so, finally, once more, we turn to great confrontations, meetings between the great and sometimes between the not-so-great, meetings which you won't find in many history books. First, a dramatic confrontation between Harold Wilson and Harold Pinter. Any offers? Peter.
Well, Harold Pinter is noted for his pauses in the play, of great significance, in the plays he writes. And so I imagine the confrontation would be Harold would say, Wilson this is. Hello, Harold. Long pause. And remember, Pinter gets royalties for these pauses. Harold says, Harold Wilson says, hello, Harold, again. A further long pause. Whereupon Harold Wilson, with his endemic wit and natural talent and ability to spoil a punchline, says, I've heard about a pay pause, but this is ridiculous.
Second, what was said when two good sports met, Don Juan and Don Bradman?
Congratulations on your overnight stand.
Marvellous. Third, one of the great encounters of all time, when the astronomer Copernicus met Patrick Moore.
Well, Patrick Moore would have said, this is the most tremendously exciting encounter between one of the very great astronomers in the whole of history, on the one hand, and Copernicus on the other. And she's got tiny eyebrows, and, of course, there have been literally millions and millions of developments in astronomy since his time, and I can see he's literally bursting to ask me all about them, but unfortunately that's all the time we've got. And,
fourthly, what was said, or perhaps sung, when the composer or the songwriter Sammy Khan met Genghis Khan?
Oh, dear. I think it was after one of Genghis Khan's peculiarly revolting exploits. He just made a mountain of human heads 100 foot high, which inspired Sammy Khan to write his song Call Me Irresponsible.
Right. At the end of the quiz this week, in fact, I'm delighted to tell you that Richard Boston tied equally with Peter Cook. On the other hand, it's a bit difficult to tie any other way. But equally, going back to famous last words, for our last words this week, may I quote to you the actual last words of Samuel Butler, that is to say, the man who wrote Erewhon and The Way of All Flesh and all that. I haven't a clue why he said them, but with his dying breath, he exclaimed to the person who was with him,
"Have you brought the checkbook, Alfred?"
Goodbye.
Taking part in Quote Unquote this week were Richard Boston, Peter Cook, Joe Kendall and John Wells. The quotations were spoken by me, Ronald Fletcher. The programme was devised and introduced by Nigel Rees and produced by John Lloyd.